From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Oscar Wilde once wrote, "The first duty in life is to assume a pose. What the second is, no one has yet discovered." Tobias Wolff uses that quote to open his memoir, This Boy's Life. On today's Fresh Air, Wolff talks about the poses he assumed and the lies he told to create the person he wanted to be. In the 1940s, tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquette played with the Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie bands. We talk with him about coming up through the ranks to lead his own big band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new documentary film on the late trumpeter and singer Chet Baker. And television critic David Bianculli says goodbye to Miami Vice and Family Ties. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. So absolutely clear and hypnotic is Tobias Wolff's painful memoir of growing up in the 1950s that a reader wants to take it apart and find some simple way to describe why it works so beautifully. That's how Christopher Lehmann-Haupt began his New York Times review of Wolff's new book, This Boy's Life. Wolff's memoir is something of a companion piece to his brother Jeffrey's acclaimed book, The Duke of Deception, a portrait of their father who was a con man and fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel skills and manners, how to shoot, how to read respectfully, how to box, and how to handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. Jeffrey's memoir is about discovering his father was a fraud. Tobias's memoir is about traveling west with a loving mother who wanted to make a new life but kept ending up with abusive men. Tobias Wolff won a 1985 Penn Faulkner Award for his short novel, The Barracks Thief. I wanted to know if Jeffrey's book, The Duke of Deception, inspired Tobias to write his new memoir.
Not really. In fact, my tendency was to avoid the idea of writing a memoir because he had written one originally. And I thought, well, you know, what's to be said here? But in fact, we had completely different lives. He grew up in the East. I grew up in the West. He grew up in rather privileged circumstances, and I did not. We grew up in different classes, really, and had lost touch with each other, in fact, for many, many years. So I had a completely different story to tell.
How did that come to be? How did it come to be that you went with your mother and he went with your father when your parents separated?
Well, when our parents were divorced, we were each given a choice as to who to go with, and I was very young at the time, and it wasn't much of a choice anyway. I hardly knew my father, and I never did get to know him very well. But, of course, I stayed with my mother, and my brother was very attached to my father and went with him.
What was the experience like for you of reading your brother's book, The Duke of Deception, which really told about all the lies your father had created over the years, the fake history of himself that he had made up?
It was not a surprise, of course, because my brother and I are very close, and we have and I did indeed get to know my father later on in my life. We had talked about all these things before. I thought it was brilliantly written, a very moving book about his life with my father. It was a book mostly about my father. When I came to write my own memoir, it was. I have young boys, and what was beginning to interest me was just the whole question of growing up and how you make a self, how you decide who you are, and that's what my book is about. It's really more about my own growing up, and it's my mother is a very strong figure in the book, as she was in my life and is in my life. But the concentration of my book is on this process of growing up.
Let me ask you to read the very beginning of your new memoir, This Boy's Life.
Good. Our car boiled over again just after my mother and I crossed the Continental Divide. While we were waiting for it to cool, we heard, from somewhere above us, the bawling of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past us into the next curve, its trailer shimmying wildly. We stared after it. "Oh, Toby," my mother said. "He's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, then faded in the wind that sighed in the trees all around us. By the time we got there, quite a few people were standing along the cliff where the truck went over. It had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. It looked pitifully small. A stream of thick black smoke rose from the cab, feathering out in the wind. My mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident. Someone had. We stood with the others at the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. My mother put her arm around my shoulder. For the rest of the day, she kept looking over at me, touching me, brushing back my hair. I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs. I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable, tooled leather saddle. It was 1955, and we were driving from Florida to Utah to get away from a man my mother was afraid of and to get rich on uranium. We were going to change our luck.
One of the things I really like about that beginning is the sense of disaster can happen in any second. A truck could just lose its brakes and go over the cliff. And your mother's going to try to be a good mother, and you're going to be a kid. I mean, it's just out of control. You're a kid. You're going to manipulate her to get that souvenir.
That's right. Yeah. It's an emblem of the book, in a way, that episode. We still talk about that episode. It made such an indelible impression on us. But
why? Why did it?
Well, we were so full of hope and going to this new life, and just for a moment there, we were too foolish for our optimism ever to get dampened for long, but just for a moment there, we tasted it, you know. We tasted our mortality, and we tasted the vanity of our hopes, seeing this man who probably was very hopeful himself about getting home for dinner that night, finishing his run, suddenly have everything go wrong on him. And I've never forgotten it. I can still see his face in the windshield.
You talked about how this memoir for you is really about coming of age, finding out who you are, who you want to be, and trying to become that. Your father transformed himself through lying, through making up a false history, through making up lineage that he didn't have, through even lying about his furniture and where that came from, making things into antiques that weren't.
Right.
Your mother wanted to transform herself and wanted to change her luck, but the way she ended up actually taking action was to hook up with different men.
Yes.
And all of those men ended up being disasters. They abused both your mother and you. And she seemed to really be unaware that that was going to happen each time she'd meet a new man. But you seemed to always know.
No, I didn't always know this was going to happen until it happened. I in a sense conspired in this by not learning my lesson either. We went from one man like this to another. It's true. But I think that what's more important than this is what we made of these situations. I mean, it's true that we drifted into these rather violent and frightening situations sometimes together, but we always kept faith with each other, and we kept our pluck, and we changed our luck again and again. We reinvented the circumstances. We'd go somewhere else and try again, and eventually, oddly enough, we were right. It worked. We both translated ourselves to different people and to better lives.
When you were young and you were in the Boy Scouts, you liked to really read the Boy Scouts magazine, Boy's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that really appeal to you? Your life was very different from the kind of mainstream view of what a Boy Scout should be, the good and healthy, wholesome life.
Yeah, that's right. I think that when I was reading it, I fell into a kind of spell in which I believed I was those boys that the magazine was about, these boys who saved lives and had trap lines in the Arctic, and boys who built airplanes in their backyards and flew them at state fairs, these extraordinary young entrepreneurs. And while I was reading this magazine, I felt like I was participating in this ideal American boyhood that all the movies I went to and the television shows and the radio shows that I listened to sort of invited us all to believe we were living. And there's a strange disjunction that happens with children in this country between the ideal childhood that's proposed to them. We're a culture that has a kind of worship of children and childhood, and yet people don't really live those lives. So they look at them from a distance with kind of worshipful eyes and pretend they're living them. So that magazine was very, very important to me in that way when I was young. That's why I called this memoir of mine, This Boy's Life. It's to distinguish between that ideal boyhood of the, you know, of Norman Rockwell, the kind of pictures that Norman Rockwell would draw of young of childhood, and the kind that I and in fact most of the boys I knew when I was growing up actually lived.
You really wanted to have a conventional life and a conventional family.
Sure. I think it's a real cycle. I think that children who grow up in safe, secure, conventional, middle-class families all want to become outlaws and rebels and live in dirty apartments and never do the dishes. And children who grow up chaotically and poverty and who have no automatic hold on respectability in the world come to prize conventionality and security. Yes, that's what I wanted when I don't want it so much anymore, I think, but I sure did want it when I was a boy.
Your mother wanted a good family that spent time together also, and I really like what you write about that. You say, Mother insisted we spend time together like a real family. Our failure was ordained because the real family we set out to imitate doesn't exist in nature. A real family as troubled as ours would never dream of spending time together.
That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that line. That's right.
But how much of that charade did you go through?
We had the life I led with my first stepfather and his family, and that we led with them, and we did. We had these rituals of family life, and they were they gave us for a little while the appearance, and we actually probably believed that we were a real family when we would sit together and watch Lawrence Welk. I can't hear the name today without wilting. Mitch something in the sing-along
Mitch
gang.
Mitch Miller.
He used to make us watch Mitch Miller. We'd all sit around. That was our idea of a family evening, is sitting in front of the tube and watching Lawrence Welk and Mitch Miller. And my stepfather would get his old saxophone out and sit there oh, Lord. Don't make me relive it again.
I don't know. You've just been through it in your book, although you left out that particular story.
The Mitch Miller one I did, I left out, but I've got Lawrence Welk in there all right.
Tobias Wolff is my guest, and his new memoir is called This Boy's Life. There's a scene that you describe, one of the father figures in your life, one of the men that your mother had hooked up with for a while, gave you a Winchester, a rifle, and one day you were leaning out the window, aiming the rifle out the window, pointing at a couple who were walking by, and you pulled the trigger and actually didn't shoot the couple, you shot a squirrel. But in describing that scene, in reading that scene, I couldn't help but wonder whether, looking back, you think you were ever on the verge of really becoming one of those neighbors next door who goes nuts and kills somebody?
Well, in a way, I guess the point of that scene is that anybody can become someone like that almost inadvertently. It's funny, my friends, when they've read that section, the men, not the women, have almost all said to me, incidentally, I was not aiming the rifle at these people when I pulled the trigger. I was aiming at something else. But it is true that I used to aim the rifle out the window at people walking past. And every boy I know who grew up in a house where there were weapons did things like that. They've all told me that. It is a very typical thing. What do you think kids do with those things? They watch when the things we watch in the movies and TV kind of take away our sense of mortality, that, you know, that things don't have consequences when you point guns at people. There, you'll see them next week on another show, and we have an infatuation in this country with firearms and handling them, and boys left alone in a house. I think girls are not so interested in them, but boys left alone in a house with a weapon are going to get that weapon out and they're going to point it.
Your memoir, This Boy's Life, is about how you invented and reinvented yourself, and perhaps the most stunning reinvention of yourself that you're responsible for is how you got into prep school. Just to explain here, although your father had for a while been rich, your mother, who you were with, was always poor. And when you were in, I guess it was junior high school, you and your brother started communicating. And your brother urged you to try to get away from your father, who was your stepfather, who was beating you, and try to get into prep school. And he said he'd try to help you. So you got really hooked on the idea and tried to get a scholarship. So what you did was you made up letters of recommendations from all of your teachers, and you tried to really write it in their tone of voice. And you wrote, "And on the boy who lived in their letters, the splendid phantom who carried all my hopes, it seemed to me at last I saw my own face." And I thought that's so convincing, that you were really, truly writing letters about the boy who you think you were or deserved to be as a boy, as opposed to the boy who you were forced to become.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all have a kind of dream self.
Mm-hmm.
And in making, in writing those, my actual self, I'm afraid, wasn't quite the boy that I portrayed in those letters. I was a very indifferent student in a very bad school. And lazy, and I didn't even go to school a lot of the time. I hung out with a bad bunch, and I mean, they were actually good guys, really looking back on it. But they were considered a bad bunch then, and I was no model of American boyhood, and I had to get a scholarship to this prep school, and it was quite clear to me that being the boy I was, in fact, was not going to get me in. I couldn't even get a letter of recommendation from my teachers. So I decided to take this task on myself. What did I have to lose, right? I'd end up, if I lost, being where I was. So I basically wrote down in these letters of recommendation that I made up a picture of the boy that I dreamed I really was if everybody just knew me, actually, as well as I knew myself. And you know, the straight-A student, the Eagle Scout, upright fellow. And manufactured this identity and did it, I guess, persuasively enough, since I did get it, a scholarship to a fine prep school, which changed my life completely.
Did you do a convincing job of reinventing yourself at prep school, because you had to pretend to be the boy who you had described in these letters, the boy who got you into this school?
No, it didn't hold up very well. For one thing, coming from such a lousy school as I was coming from, and not having been a good student at that school anyway, I didn't know very much. I was very ignorant, and my teachers were puzzled at how little I knew, considering the brilliant transcripts that came in. I had a friend in the school office at that school who gave me the school transcript form, so I made out my own grades, and I awarded myself straight A's and in courses that I hadn't even taken in order to get in. So I didn't know very much. I had a terrible time academically at the school, but an English teacher there took me under his wing and tutored me and gave me books, and I was excited about reading anyway, but he taught me to be a systematic and careful reader, and he excited me about writing, as indeed my brother had also, and really brought me along. It was the pivotal experience of my life, being at that school and being under that man's tutelage, and I owe, you know, just all kinds of things to him for that. So it turned out to be a wonderful, almost fairy tale escape for me, and I loved the school. But no, the act didn't hold up, and eventually it fell apart, and I was, in my senior year there, in my last year, my sixth form year, I was asked to leave.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and about your writing, but first we'll take a very short break. My guest is Tobias Wolff. His new memoir is called This Boy's Life. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tobias Wolff, we were just talking about how you lied your way into prep school, but eventually got thrown out. Do you believe in lying when it's the only way to get what you need, and when you know that ultimately you're not telling a terrible mistruth, that it won't be a malicious mistruth?
Well, on the one hand, as a writer, I'm committed to truth. I mean, in this book about a boy who lies, I am very scrupulous in telling the truth, and the book is in a lot of ways about the cost of not telling the truth. So no, ultimately, I think lies subtract from your substance as a person, and the more of them you tell, the more you beggar yourself. But I will distinguish between lying and invention, and especially self-invention, children need to try on different selves. They don't know who they are. They try different things. You'll see the way kids change their hair constantly, you know, their hairdos, and experiment with their clothes and all that. It's really all sort of fumbling around trying to figure out who they are. And so there's a period when you're young when I think especially parents have to be very careful not to apply standards about lying to what is naturally occurring in the child's life in terms of just figuring out who they are and trying on different selves. And sometimes that involves acts of self-invention. And I think that, you know, that we have to be very tolerant about that.
Even when you're trying very hard to tell the truth, there are so many different versions of the truth. Did you run into that when writing this memoir? I think you gave the manuscript to your mother and to your brother and to others to read before
yes,
it was published.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to be sure that when it came out, they wouldn't say, oh, no, this is, not to others, but to me, you got it all wrong. And I was very gratified that they were very impressed by the accuracy of the record and that it really squared with their own recollections. My mother had some questions about chronology. She has a wonderful kind of memory, and she says here and there I got things switched around and whatnot, but nothing serious at all. And basically I let those things stand because that's the way I remembered them, and that's the story I'm telling is what my memory tells me. You can follow someone around with a camera and a notebook and a tape recorder, and you'll get a lot of facts, but you won't get the truth. The truth lies in the memory, and because that's the story you tell yourself about who you are and where you come from, where you've been. And so I was very attentive to my memory and trusted that.
You and your brother have both written memoirs about your childhood. You've read each other's books, and you've become very close over the years, even though you were separated from each other during childhood.
Maybe that's why we're close.
Did you ever go through a period of envying each other's lives? Did you ever wish you'd stayed with your father? Did your father ever wish he'd stayed with your mother? Did he ever wish he was poor, like you were often poor? Did you ever wish that you had money like he did?
I can't speak for him. I don't think that he ever wished to be poor. I don't think anybody ever wished to be poor. But I certainly spent a lot of time wishing I was rich. And my father was a very charismatic guy. Though I hardly knew him, I remembered him well. I could remember the sort of tobacco smell that used to cling to his tweeds. He had a deep, grumbling voice, and he was big and had a very bearish kind of presence. And I remember lying in my bed at night and hearing his voice come through the bedroom wall, that rumble of his, and how secure I'd feel hearing that. So there were, you know, I longed to be with my father, not to be with my mother, but to be with my father also. And I romanticized him and idealized him to an extraordinary degree, as you do with an absent parent. When the parent is there and you experience the humanity of that and the flaws and natural difficulty of living with another person from day to day, you can't do that. But children who are separated for years and years from their parents without seeing them, oddly enough, develop very, very idealized notions of them. And I certainly did with my father.
We were talking about lies before. What was the most damaging lie that your father told you?
It wasn't so much lies he told me, but truths that he did not tell me. I was led to believe by him that we came from an aristocratic family, and that he had coats of arms and all this. And my mother was Irish Catholic. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and he objected to this. He said his family had always been Episcopalians and everything. Well, it turned out my father's family were a wonderful Jewish family of doctors and brilliant surgeons with their own claim to respect and stature, which he and some he didn't want to be Jewish, and he cut my brother and I off not only from that knowledge but from the knowledge of that of his wonderful family because he didn't want us to understand this about him and consequently about ourselves. And so we lost that half of our family, when my brother went back to write about my father and interviewed these people, they were wonderful people, and it broke our hearts that we had been denied their company when we were growing up and the richness of that life that they had in Hartford. So, you know, his lies had terrible, terrible consequences on us, as his absence did on me. That's partly what this book is about. I don't romanticize lying in this book. I talk about self-invention. I talk about lies, and the lies, you know, the big lies in this book cause inestimable harm.
You said earlier that when you were young, you really wanted a conventional family, but you implied you don't really feel exactly that way now.
Well, in some ways I do. I mean, but
I should say here that I think you're married and have two children. Is
oh
that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think what it is. Is that kind of hankering for respectability that children have who feel that in some way or other they aren't respectable. And no, that's what I was talking about. I mean, I just don't go around worrying about that very much anymore. I don't care all that much anymore what people think of me. I do care a lot about what they think of my work because I'm less vulnerable to the opinion of others than I was when I was a boy.
This is, I believe, the first really autobiographical thing that you've written. You've written stories about other people, and they are indirectly autobiographical. But this is direct autobiography.
Yes,
do you feel exposed by it? What's the experience been for you?
Yes, I do. In the past, when people are, as I say, the way we're talking right now, if I'm being interviewed about a collection of stories or a novel that I've written, people will talk about the characters, and it's quite clear these are characters, these are inventions, even though obviously they may spring from some origin in my life. We're talking about figures in a book. And now when we're talking about this book, you know, clearly we're talking about me, or at least my idea of who I am and the people I've known. And yes, I do feel vulnerable. I think I'd be crazy if I didn't.
But is that an acceptable feeling to you? I mean, will you continue to write directly about yourself?
Probably not, but not because I'm afraid of that feeling. No, this wasn't the first installment in a series of memoirs, such as, say, Jimmy Carter might write about the landscape of his life and the great figures he's known and the Camp David Accords. I mean, it's not like that. I just found something. I've always thought that those events that I recount in this book had a very interesting, almost novelistic shape to them, and have been wanting to write the story for years about growing up. It's really about the experience of growing up in this country, being kind of outside the circle of privilege, but wanting in badly, and what you'll do to get there.
One last thing. Do you think that your writing changed at all, that the voice you used was different because you were writing in first person?
Yes. Yes, it was, dear. It's a little fuller. I tend to have I think it's a warmer voice. It tends to be I tended to really pull out the stops when I wrote this. I just imagined talking to a great friend, you know, when I was writing this book, and let it rip.
You going to do that the next time you write something? Imagine that you're talking to a great friend.
Yes, probably so. I enjoy using the voice in this, and I don't know what my ne- I don't know what it, you know. I'm writing stories again now, and I don't know what they're going to be like in the end.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Good talking to you.
Tobias Wolff's memoir, This Boy's Life, was published earlier this year by the Atlantic Monthly Press. Wolf won the Penn Faulkner Award for his novel The Barracks Thief. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll be coming to you from San Francisco. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Illinois Jacquette has spent his life playing jazz, but his tenor saxophone playing also inspired many rhythm and blues musicians. Coming up, Jacquette remembers some of the bands he's played with, led by Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie, and we talk about his own big band. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Let's Get Lost, the new film documentary on the life of the late trumpeter and singer Chet Baker. And it's goodbye to Miami Vice and Family Ties. Television critic David Bianculli assesses their final episodes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. President Bush today announced a broad plan to deal with the problem of drug trafficking and violent crime. The focus of the plan is on tougher enforcement and longer sentences. He will not seek restrictions on the sale and manufacture of assault weapons. Details from NPR's Jim Angle.
The focus of the president's proposal is on those who commit crimes rather than on the guns they use. He proposes spending an additional $1.2 billion for 875 more federal agents, 1,600 more prosecutors, and 24,000 more prison beds. He said many criminals see the criminal justice system as a crapshoot where the risks are worth the rewards. The system must be fixed, he said, so that criminals have a different expectation of what will happen to them.
If you commit a crime, you will be caught, and if caught, you will be prosecuted, and if convicted, you will do time.
The president also wants to double the mandatory sentence for possessing a weapon during the commission of a crime involving drugs or violence to 10 years. The president said he will make permanent the eventual decision by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms on banning imported weapons that are not deemed suitable for sporting purposes, but the president did not propose any limits on domestically made weapons, except to call for banning the sale of magazines that hold more than 15 rounds. Law enforcement officials say they wanted more and will now look to Congress to provide it. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
U.S. Marshals today began evicting residents from some 300 public and private housing units in Washington, D.C. The dwellings were suspected crack houses. The Bush administration has decided to take on the district's drug problem and earlier this month unveiled a program that includes evicting drug offenders from federally funded housing projects. The United States withdrew its ambassador from Panama today, recalling him to Washington for consultations with President Bush. As he left, the ambassador turned up the verbal assault on Panama's military leader, General Manuel Noriega. From Panama City, Alan Tomlinson has details.
Ambassador Arthur Davis fired off a volley of parting shots at General Noriega before boarding his plane home. He accused him of running a police state and said last Wednesday's televised attack on opposition election candidates amounted to an assassination attempt. The U.S. ambassador said he was sure there were honorable members of Panama's own defense forces who deplored the attack and hoped they might eventually move to oust Noriega themselves. The recall to Washington of Ambassador Davis will be followed by the withdrawal of more than half the U.S. Embassy staff in Panama at a time when U.S. troop strength here is being increased. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Panama City.
Senate investigators today accused the Indian Health Service of purposely trying to impede the panel's probe of allegedly misappropriated funds and other irregularities within the agency. Democrat Dennis DeConcini said none of eight other government agencies being investigated by his special committee has been as difficult to deal with. Officials of the Health Service were scheduled to testify today, but DeConcini said the committee was not ready to begin its questioning because the agency had not supplied requested information until Friday. The Supreme Court upset a 36-year-old precedent today, ruling that investors' claims against stockbrokers must be resolved under arbitration agreements signed by customers, not in court. Today's action reverses a 1953 decision and is expected to boost arbitration as the main way to resolve investor-broker disputes. Today's 5-4 decision involves investor claims against Shearson American Express. In other action, justices ruled that citizens suing over alleged police brutality only have to prove officers acted unreasonably, not that they were malicious or sadistic. Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 25 points, closing at 2438.89. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz trumpeter Chet Baker died a year ago this month after falling from a hotel window in Amsterdam. Dutch authorities called it suicide. The U.S. consulate ruled it an accident, but some of his friends think he was murdered. Drug paraphernalia was found in his room, but no traces of drugs were found in his body. At the time of Baker's death, the filmmaker and commercial photographer Bruce Weber was finishing up the editing of his documentary film about Baker called Let's Get Lost. The film recently opened in New York, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has this review.
Bruce Weber's first documentary, Broken Noses, was about small-time boxer Andy Minsker. But the film was dedicated to jazz trumpeter Chet Baker, had lots of Baker on the soundtrack, and according to Weber, had been made partly because of Minsker's uncanny resemblance to the young Chet Baker. So it was no surprise that Weber's second film, Let's Get Lost, is about Chet Baker himself. It's a fascinating marriage of observer and subject. Not so much a great movie about jazz as it is a study of a musician whose success owed something to his movie star charisma. In the 1950s, Chet Baker was the closest thing to a matinee idol jazz had. Sinfully photogenic, with cheekbones you could park a car on and an insolent turned-up nose, Baker had a vulnerably introverted manner like James Dean. His image was bound up with his reflective trumpet playing. Throughout his career, he was plagued by inaccurate comparisons to Miles Davis, and his trumpet playing inspired his singing. Actually, it was more like sighing. Baker never had much of a voice, but what voice he had seemed to ooze with sex appeal.
There's no love song finer, but how strange the change from major to minor every time.
Let's Get Lost doesn't ignore Chet Baker the musician. We see and hear Baker in a studio, recording music for the film, almost all of it at the same sleepwalking tempo. We see clips of some TV appearances from the 50s and 60s, and Weber uses witnesses like record producer Dick Bach and trumpeter Jack Sheldon to sketch a simplified history of Baker's career. Baker made his name in the early 50s when he played a few dates with Charlie Parker and was a founding member of baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan's pianoless quartet. That groundbreaking unit helped put West Coast cool jazz on the map. The Mulligan Quartet reinforced the stereotype of laid-back coastal living, and Baker was very much a product of California's car culture. While with Mulligan, he wrote a zippy tune called Freeway. In the film, he says the best day of his life was when he got his Alfa Romeo. Weber films Baker riding around Santa Monica in big old Cadillac convertibles, surrounded by pretty women. Baker said filming those scenes was like a dream, but they have a nightmarish tinge, underscored by the crisp, dark, black-and-white photography. The young Chet Baker looked like a golden boy. But in the 80s, after decades of drug abuse, after he lost his teeth and his cheeks caved in, Oklahoma-born Baker looked like some weather-beaten Okie in a 1930s Walker Evans photograph. When Baker hangs out with his young lookalike Andy Minsker, the effect is creepy. It's like watching a live-action picture of Dorian Gray.
If I to eat and sleep and pray. Blame it on my years.
Let's Get Lost isn't a totally flattering portrait of Chet Baker. Ex-wives testify to his ways as an emotional con artist. Three of his children testify to his parental neglect. But the man had a mystique, which paid off in a brief movie career. We see a little of Baker in a 1955 low-budget war movie, Hell's Horizon, and in a hilarious Italian beatnik picture from 1959. He could have been a contender. In fact, the 1960 hipster film, All the Fine Young Cannibals, was conceived as a Baker vehicle to be based on his life. But one of his many drug busts nixed the deal, and the story was changed. Weber includes a clip from the film of a trumpet-playing Robert Wagner, coiffed to look like Baker, and you realize how much Baker fed Hollywood stereotypes of self-destructive jazzmen. He was the Eisenhower era's Bix Beiderbecke, the cool school's young man with a horn. Chet Baker was many things that couldn't be separated: trumpeter, singer, heartthrob, junkie, con man, and Let's Get Lost fits them all together. For that alone, it's a remarkable piece of work.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. The soundtrack album for Let's Get Lost is on the RCA Novus label. This is Fresh Air. Roy Jacquette has spent his life playing jazz, but his honking tenor saxophone solos inspired many rhythm and blues players. Jacquette's jazz career dates back to his early childhood when he sang and danced in his father's big bands. In the 1940s, he played in bands led by Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie, and played in the Jazz at the Philharmonic tours. After several decades of performing in small groups, Jacquette wanted to play in a big band again. So in 1983, he formed his own, encouraged by the success of a student big band he formed at Harvard, where he was an artist in residence. When I spoke with Jacquette a few months ago, his big band had just released a new album. It was his first American release in 19 years. When you were putting together your big band, what configuration of horns and saxophones did you know you want, and what kind of thought went into that, deciding how many of each there'd be?
Well, see, I knew what I wanted before I even organized the band. I knew how it should sound, and five saxophones, which Count Basie had when I was in the band, and four trumpets, and three or four trombones, and a full rhythm section with piano, bass, and drums. And so I knew all about what a big band should be. I like harmony. I like trombones. I like trumpets. I like saxophones. I like rhythm sections.
And good arrangements.
And the best arrangements, you know. And that, you can do a lot. You can play soft and whisper with a big band, because you can have arrangements that are so beautiful until you forget about how the size of the band.
Well, let me give an example of what you're talking about. On the new record, you have a beautiful version of More Than You Know, and it's you play beautifully on that with the band behind you.
Thank you.
ask you some things about your past. Your grandfather was a musician, and you sang and danced in your father's big band. How did your father feel about bringing you into clubs when you were just a child and exposing you to alcohol and to the club scene? Was he at all uncomfortable about that?
No, not at all. My mother and father, they loved music, and all three of my brothers played music. All my two sisters sang and danced, and I was the baby. And wherever they went, I went. And they knew that I had the talent. They knew I was going to do something. So there was no stopping me from doing anything.
After high school, you moved to Los Angeles, and you hooked up with Lionel Hampton there. You were introduced to Hampton by Nat Cole?
Yes. He jammed with the King Cole Trio, and I was as an invited guest along with him, and that's when I met him, and he heard me, and we really had a jam session that, you know, Hamp loves to play, and Nat, everybody just loved to play, and I loved to play, so we played, and he called me over and asked me what I'd like to join his band. He was forming a band. So he asked me would I mind switching from the alto saxophone to the tenor saxophone.
Why did he want you to switch?
Well, he figured that the style that I was doing on the alto saxophone, if I would play it on the tenor, it would be more effective for his band. And I had to think about that. That was quite a decision to make. But if I wanted to join a named band, this was my chance, and that's why I switched.
So what was it like the first time you picked up the tenor saxophone?
Well, the first time I picked up the tenor saxophone, I sounded like Lester Young, because that's what I heard out of that horn. And I kept playing different styles of Coleman Hawkins a little here, and a little bit of Don Byers, Ben Webster, and some of the greats. You know, I always listen to the musicians, you know, the ones that really can play, you know, and they are your greatest teachers when you're learning how to play. So I could play like all the greats, but I had no style of my own, see, and you have to create something for your own if you want to last in this business. So when we got ready to record, to make my first record, now I was in trouble, see, because now what I'm going to do for myself, I had to talk to myself, and that was the trap that I was in. And Marshall Rawl, who was the first saxophone player in my Hampton band, a great musician and a great saxophonist, he knew that I could play like everybody. And just as I got up to go to the mic, he whispered in my ear, say, "Go for yourself." I said, "Go for myself." And as I was walking up to the microphone, that's when I created this solo on Flying Home. May the 26th, 1942, on Decca Records.
Age 19 when you made that record.
Yes.
How did your recording of Flying Home change your life? People started noticing you.
Well, no one could follow that song when we played. None of the acts could come on behind that. The show was over every night. I remember when engagement we played at the Golden Gate Theater, and the people got so carried away with this solo until you could see the balcony about to cave in from the stage. You could see it. It created excitement that you could never believe. You'd have to be there and be playing it to realize what was happening. And it was all me. And it just changed my whole life into knowing and gave me the confidence that I had to take care of myself, and I had to really continue to do things in music that I'd never believed that I could do.
You've played with a lot of great band leaders. You've played with Lionel Hampton, Count Basie, with Cab Calloway. You grew up playing with your father. What kind of band leader are you? And have you taken any of your cues from the band leaders who you've played with?
Yes. Well, in my father's band, the dissonant was there. And I learned that from him, that timing was very essential, that without time, without making time, you're going to play like that. And when I joined the Hampton Band, I learned about the excitement, that the showmanship that Hampton, he's a great showman along with his talent. And when I joined the Cavs Band, I learned how to discipline yourself to dress. Cap was one of the best dressed leaders that you could want to see on stage. He had special clothes and special shoes, and it was everything out there. And I learned from that. When I joined the Count Basie Band, I learned the discipline of calling a set, programming your music, take a big band and make it whisper, so when you came to the excitement, it would be an explosion of music. So I mold all that into my being in front of my big band, and I am so happy to be in front of this band. I've never been as happy as I am now.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Illinois Jacquette's new big band album, Jacquette's Got It, is on Atlantic Records. This is Fresh Air.
It's Noah Adams, National Public Radio in Washington. Coming up today on All Things Considered, Arthur Davis, the U.S. ambassador to Panama, who's been recalled from that country, accuses the Noriega regime there of attempting to assassinate Guillermo Ford, one of the opposition vice presidential candidates who was beaten last week. Also, Denver, the city, is trying to decide whether or not to build a new airport, and there have been complaints there about a negative advertising campaign led by Roger Ailes. And we'll talk with Witold Rybczynski. He's an architect and writer. His new book is called The Most Beautiful House in the World. He discusses the homes of Robert Louis Stevenson and Mark Twain, and also his own house that he built over a long period of time, starting with a boat shed south of Montreal. That's coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The end of the TV season is bringing the final episodes of several long-running series. Television critic David Bianculli has been thinking about how TV shows say goodbye.
Michael J. Fox!
Family Ties closed shop over the weekend by going out with a bang and with a curtain call for the entire cast. As finale episodes go, it was pretty good. Alex, played by Michael J. Fox, left home to seek his fame and fortune. And since Fox is doing the same thing and has a brighter future than any of the Family Ties co-stars he's leaving behind, the episode's plot was both appropriate and satisfying. It was a lot more satisfying than most of Moonlighting, which also broadcast its final episode on Sunday. Family Ties got to say goodbye, but Moonlighting was basically being thrown out of the house. And the final show's first 50 minutes showed why. It was another tired, unfunny episode with an unappealing romantic subplot and no real sense of enjoyment. But then, just when it looked like Moonlighting couldn't even exit with class, Bruce Willis, as David Addison, returned to the Blue Moon office to find a network executive repossessing the furniture.
Walter Whitebread, ABC TV. Used to be a big fan of yours. Well, still am, I guess. Well, next 8 minutes and 36 seconds.
Look, Walter, I enjoy a joke as much as anybody, but I gotta get some work done, so you wanna have him bring the stuff back in?
You don't know, do you?
Know what?
Somebody from Current Programs is supposed to call you. I guess that's why NBC's number one, huh? I don't know how to tell you this, but you're canceled.
It's not that original an idea. Remember the classic Saturday Night Live sketch where Elliot Gould played the network executive who canceled Star Trek? In that sketch, the characters tried desperately to save their own lives, and that's what David and Maddie tried to do as the clock counted down on Moonlighting. But wherever they turned, they got well-deserved criticism instead of help. Ms. DePesto, played by Elise Beasley, yelled at David and Maddie. but could just as easily have been yelling at Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd, whose off-screen feuds were one of the show's biggest problems.
Agnes, I think there's something you should know.
What? That the two of you couldn't figure out your nitwit relationship, so they're giving the rest of us the heave-ho along with you?
You heard, huh?
Yeah, I heard. If there's a God in heaven, he'll spin Herbert and me off in our own series.
Then they go to the show's producer, who's watching outtakes in a screening room and doesn't even stop the projector while talking to them.
Hey, even I can't get people to tune in to watch what they don't want to watch anymore. Don't get me wrong. I love you two kids. But can you really blame the audience? Case of Poison Ivy's more fun than watching you two lately.
Ah, what are you talking about? What about all the laughs we had?
Yeah.
People don't want laughs, David. They want romance.
Romance?
And romance is a very fragile thing. Once it's over, it's over. And I'm afraid for you too, it's over.
The show ended with David and Maddie at the altar. Not getting married, but just sitting there alone, thinking about old times while scenes from the good old days of moonlighting flashed on the screen. It was a reminder of how good the series had once been, and how far it had fallen since. But in the last few scenes of the last episode of Moonlighting, the pieces all came together one last time. So in the final episode rankings, in terms of how a show says goodbye, I'd put Moonlighting slightly ahead of Family Ties. All Family Ties had to do at the end was wave goodbye. Moonlighting had to face a firing squad, and did it with dignity. Neither one, though, is up there with the classic final episodes of St. Elsewhere and The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Well, next up is Miami Vice, which concludes this Sunday with a 2-hour finale. But unless they chase and catch a one-armed man, I can't imagine getting too worked up about it.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. For the next couple of days, Fresh Air will be coming to you from San Francisco. We're looking forward to talking with some of the Bay Area's notables, including Oscar award-winning computer animator John Lasseter, Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart, and writer Jessica Mitford. So I hope you'll be able to join us from San Francisco. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.